Hey, it's Francis. You know, the other day I was making pancakes for my kid and she started complaining that there weren't chocolate chips in them. And so I'm like, yeah, but can't you taste the love in them? And she goes, no. Anyway, Daddy, love is not a kind of food. She really wanted chocolate chips. And I'm laughing about it now, but honestly, it was one of those days where I really couldn't tell if feeding your kids is the greatest thing or the worst thing in the world. So that's pretty much what this episode from last year was about. Check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So, I love him to death, but my dad never cooked for us when I was growing up. I mean, really, almost literally never. I can remember exactly 3 times in my life that he made food for us, and one of them turned out to be a dream I had. And, you know, I think it was mostly just a cultural and generational thing, but, you know, now I look around at all my fellow dad friends, and so many of them cook for their families, at least part of the time. So it seems pretty normalized to me, which is interesting. And I also realized that I mostly hang around, you know, food people, which led me to another question. How do you learn to cook for kids if you actually first learn to cook as a professional? Or even if you just learn to cook, you know, by watching cool chefs on TV or whatever. Anyway, with all this stuff swirling around in my head, I wanted to spend some time this week with some of the best dad cooks I know, to talk about our experiences, to learn their best tricks to get dinner done every night, and, you know, feel a little bit like it's okay that it feels so hard some of the time. Later in the show, we'll talk with David Chang, the founder of Momofuku, and one of the most influential chefs in America, and the writer Chris Ying. And we start with Kenji Lopez-Ault. So Kenji's the author of the best-selling cookbook, The Food Lab, which is like a million pages of how to use food science to make you a better home cook. But when he became a parent a few years ago, you know, I wondered if he was still going to test 25 methods of applying heat to a burger for the perfect sear. And it turns out, you know, maybe not on a Tuesday night, but he's still as interested in looking into what science says about how to cook and feed your kids. Hey, Kenji, thanks for talking with us. I know you're super busy right now. You had a new book just come out. You're still working on another book. You've got all kinds of stuff going on. So thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, of course. I always have the time for you.
Aww. But hey, I want to talk to you about your kid. I guess not your kid specifically, although we can talk about it as much as any doting parent would want, I'm sure. But right. I read in a column you wrote that You've basically had your daughter with you in the kitchen, like, since she was born.
And right. I mean, since before she was born, if you want to get technical, but yes.
But I want to talk about, because, like, I have a daughter. She's, you know, they're around roughly the same age, like, you know, like older toddlers, right? And I love the idea of cooking with her, but to be completely honest, like, when she's in the kitchen with me, I often struggle to think of things she can do, right? So half the time, I just end up being like, oh, sweetie, can you, can you open the drawer? You know, can you close the drawer? And it just not very interesting, I don't think, for her. And I think she loves the idea of being useful, but, like, I don't know how to make her useful. And then next thing I'm like, okay, why don't you go play while I actually make dinner, you know? So how do you keep your kid engaged?
Well, you know, I mean, I have days like that also where it's like, you know, I know I have like 15 minutes to get dinner on the table and I'm rushing and I don't have the time to sit there and, you know, hold her hands as she's chopping vegetables or whatever. And so I'll send her off and play also. So I think, you know, it's fine to do that now and then when you really don't have the time. But, you know, there's a number of things. It depends on their age. So when she was an infant, you know, before she could stand, I basically just had her on one of those little donut cushions on top of the counter. And the ways I interacted with her was to basically just stick things in her nose. So, like, I would take whatever I'm chopping and stick a little bit of it under her nose so she can smell it. Or I would take, like, a little bit of the, you know, if I had, like, the juice from a vegetable or a fruit on my finger, I would take a little bit of it and stick it in her mouth so she could taste it and things like that. But once, you know, once they get old enough to actually stand, you know, the most important thing, I think, and the most useful tool that I've had in our kitchen was a helper stool. So something that allows them to get up to counter height so that they can see what's going on, and that they're, you know, they're stable, and so something that'll block them in on all sides so that they can't fall backwards. And once they're at counter height, you know, then they can really start getting involved with, you know, early on it's simple tasks, like it could be picking the leaves from herbs, and, you know, they don't do a great job, so you have to go over it afterwards. But the more they practice, the better they get at it. And then from then on, you can get to more and more advanced things. So one tool that I have that is legitimately useful for her and that she loves doing is a little mortar and pestle. So I have like a big one that I use, and then she has one that's like 1.5 to 2. I think it's 1.5, maybe 2 cups. You know, she can pound garlic in there, pound ginger, oh, cool. pound aromatics, you know, and that's actually useful. You know, it's like, if I give her 4 cloves of garlic and a pinch of salt in there, then I can focus on doing, you know, other tasks on my cutting board, and she'll sit there pounding for like 2 minutes. And the end result, it might take a little bit longer than if I had done it myself, but the end result is something that you can totally cook with. And so that's great because it's like she feels like she's invested in the meal. Yeah. You know, similarly, like other things that she really enjoys doing and that she's been doing since she was 1.5 or 2 years old is measuring things and dumping ingredients in bowls. So, you know, early on, like I would measure things and then, I could ask her to like transfer it from the cutting board into the bowl. And so like, if I'm making, you know, a stir fry where 4 ingredients I know are going to go into the wok at the same time, I can chop those 4 things, have them on the board. And then her job would be to transfer them to a bowl and mix them all together so that I can then add them all to the wok at the same time. So, you know, and then, knife skills also, it's like, You know, there was an NPR piece that I read a while back about, it wasn't about cooking, but it was about housework and chores around the house, and how children and toddlers in South American families tend to be a lot more actively involved with doing housework from a young age. And the whole premise of the article was that, you know, toddlers take a long time to learn things. And at first, when you get them involved with helping, it's not a help at all. You know, it makes things go slower. They make a mess.
Sure.
And, you know, like you have them do dishes and they get water all over the countertop, or they don't really do a very good job of washing the dishes. But well, parents tend to get frustrated in American households. And instead of letting the kids make those messes, they say, okay, I'll do it myself. You go play over there.
Right.
And so they don't practice it very much. Whereas in South American households, they tend to make the kids do it longer and longer until they actually get good at it. And so we applied that sort of idea, both with cleaning, you know, kids, my daughter loves doing dishes now, which is great. And now she can actually do them pretty well. But you know, we applied that same sort of thinking to cooking, and especially things like knife skills, where it's like, all right, it's going to take more work up front to get her to learn proper knife safety, and how to handle a knife. And she's not really going to do a very good job, you know, chopping even soft things at the start. But now she's 3 years old, and it's like I can tell her, you know, cut up this carrot or peel these cucumbers, and she'll do it. And it takes her a little bit longer than it would take me, but I can be doing other stuff in that time. So it's really just a matter of practice. And the more involved you get them at the start, the faster they're going to pick up those skills. And it's at the point now where she, like, When I chop things, I usually, you know, practice good safety, and I do the little claw grip and all that stuff that chefs tell cooks, you know, home cooks to do. But sometimes when I'm in a rush or if I'm cutting a specific vegetable that doesn't require that kind of hold, I'll do it a different way, and she'll be like, "Papa, you're not doing the claw." And it's like, so she, you know, it's kind of built into her now, like proper knife safety is built into her. And she's like 3 years old, and that's something that, as long as you start them early enough and really let them get involved, it's something that they'll pick up.
Yeah, I think you nailed it too. Like the key really isn't like, the key is for them to practice doing it, but also for like the adult to actually practice the patience and practice like recognizing like, it's okay. Like this is part of their learning curve.
Yeah.
And like you want them to be there learning side by side with you.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, we have a ton of questions from our listeners about eating with kids, feeding kids, in some cases cooking with kids, in some cases doing food-related things that may or may not be actual cooking. So let's start and go with an age-old classic question from Annika.
Hey, Francis. I have a question about lunch. So I make Jasper the same lunch every day. It's either peanut butter and jelly on a tortilla or rolled up ham and cheese with some sort of fruit and vegetable side. Is it okay to feed him the same thing every day? And also, is there something else that is as easy as those two things that I could make him for lunch? Also, what should I eat for lunch? Okay. Thanks for your help.
Well,
peanut butter and jelly on a tortilla, I have to say, I didn't know that was a thing. And then, you know, during COVID, we were this other family, and the dad of the other family would take the kids out on like walks whenever he had time. Like he took care of all the outside time with the kids, so they would pack up these little picnics, and every time it was peanut butter and jelly on a tortilla. I'm like, is the tortilla like, is that like the 2020 version of white bread? Like, is that all it is? It's like the modern white bread is the flour tortilla.
I mean, I find that we go through tortillas a lot more, a lot faster than bread in our house also. I don't know if that's just because I don't know if that's just, if it's some sort of mental conditioning, like anti-carb conditioning that I'm getting or I don't know. You know, these questions, you know, whereas like, is it okay asking permission to do things? Like, I always feel like the answer to those questions is yes, it's okay. Like, you know, like you don't need permission to do it. When you start worrying about things so much that you feel like you need someone else's blessing to do them, you know, then I think you're running into trouble because, well, everything is okay so long as it's in balance. You know, the way I think about nutrition and giving my daughter, a healthy variety of foods is that rather than thinking about it on a sort of individual meal basis, you know, like we have this idea in our head that like a meal needs, like every single individual meal needs to be balanced. Like I just picture, you know, when I was a kid, it was the food pyramid. Now I think it's the food plate, whatever it is. But, you know, it's this image that's ingrained in your head where every meal is supposed to have this amount of protein, this amount of carbs, this amount of vegetables. But in reality, you know, that's not how every culture around the world eats.
That's not how our bodies work. Necessarily.
And that's not necessarily how our bodies work. Yeah, you know, as long as on a macro level, you know, like from day to day or even every few days, your kids are getting a healthy mix of different things, then I think it's totally fine to give them the same thing for one given meal each day.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want, and peanut butter, you know, there's a lot of things that are worse than peanut butter and jelly, especially if you're, you know, as long as you're not using the super sugary peanut butter. Sure. Then there's a lot of things that are less healthy than peanut butter on its own.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think my kid eats a ton of peanut butter, and her same thing for meal every day thing is breakfast. She actively asks me for a bowl of oatmeal with peanut butter, and she always wants chocolate chips. So I'll give her literally like two or three chocolate chips in the bowl, and she's good. And she eats that every day, and I think, wow, that's not a lot of variety. But I'm like, wow, she's eating oatmeal, she's getting fiber, she's getting protein from the peanut butter, she's getting fat from the peanut butter. Like, I feel great having her eat that every day.
Yeah. For my daughter, it's tamago kake gohan, she calls it egg and rice and soy sauce. So every morning for breakfast, unless I specifically wake up early and start making something else for her, if I ask her what she wants for breakfast, she's like, Papa, guess what I'm going to say? And she gets that like little glint in her eye because she's about to say something that she thinks is funny. And she's like, egg and rice and soy sauce. Every day I say egg and rice and soy sauce.
Oh, that's so sweet.
And so, yes, that's what we have for breakfast almost every morning. And I microwave I make rice in a big batch, or I buy those little trays with of pre-cooked rice, and I microwave the rice for 90 seconds and then stir in an egg and some soy sauce. And that's like that. Yeah, it's the same thing every day, but it's to me, it seems healthy. Yeah. And she gets good variety with her other meals. So I don't worry too much.
Kenji Lopez Ault's latest book is a children's book. It's called Every Night is Pizza Night. And we'll be back in a minute to take more of your questions. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from NPM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've been talking to Kenji Lopez Ault, chef, food science writer, and young father. We're taking your questions about cooking and feeding kids, and if you have questions for us for a future show, record them as a voice memo on your phone and email it to contact@splendidtable.org. Now let's get to your questions with Kenji. All right, cool. Let's move on to a question from Wendy.
Hi there. Here is my question for you. I have a 3-year-old. Is it okay for me to lie to my kid to get her to eat something? I found this great recipe that I like to make. It is canned artichokes and chicken. And I love artichokes. They're like one of my favorite things. So I put the artichoke on her plate and she's like, oh no, I'm not going to eat it. We had just come back actually from a trip to the woods. She loved collecting mushrooms, which we did not eat, but she just liked collecting them. They're like these incredible little treasures to her. And I said, well, they're just like mushrooms. Knowing full well that artichokes are not like mushrooms. At least I don't think so. I have not Googled that. Anyway, so she ate it. Of course, she loved it because artichokes are the best. So I was like, yay. She ate the artichokes.
That's
and
a
she
win.
Ate the like one dish that I really like to make. But then I was like, oh, I totally lied to her. And am I ever going to have to pay the piper on that? Or is this no big deal? And I'm just psyched that I won this small battle.
I mean, I think if you get them to eat artichokes by telling them that they're mushrooms, you're that kid seems to already have a pretty healthy, healthy and adventurous palate. But you know, that said, to me, that doesn't really sound like a lie to me, because you didn't tell them that artichokes literally are mushrooms. You said that they're like mushrooms, and there are many ways in which they are like mushrooms. You know, they have similar shapes. They have a stalk with a bulbous thing on the top. You know, they can be cooked in similar ways. They probably have some similar textures.
They're not even the same kingdom, Kenji.
No, that's true. But
the plant kingdom, the fungi kingdom.
But the taxonomy of vegetables and fungus is not the only way in which things can be similar or different from each other, right? I mean, they can play similar functional roles as far as, you know, flavor and the role they play on a plate, compared to the rice or grains or meat.
Sure.
You know, the one place where I would draw the line is like, and again, this is a personal thing, but the one place where I would draw the line as far as lying to your kids is, first of all, you know, tricking them into eating vegetables by covering them up with other things. The idea of getting the vegetables into them by whatever means necessary. So like covering them up with cheese or cooking broccoli in a way that makes it so it doesn't taste like broccoli and it's just going to get covered up by everything else. When you do that, you do get vegetables into them, but you sort of ignore all of the evidence and all the research that shows that you might get broccoli into them for the first few years of their life, but you're creating someone who is less likely to like broccoli as an adult. So,
right.
I would draw the line there. And then, the other one is sort of distinguishing between animals, you know, living sentient things that you're eating versus plants. So tricking a kid into eating either meat or the other way around. But saying a mushroom is sort of like an artichoke, you know, that's not really a lie, because there are many ways in which mushrooms are like artichokes. And even if they aren't literally the same thing, I think especially from a kid's perspective, I doubt that they've learned the taxonomy of the various kingdoms yet. So, and actually, that is one strategy which I use with my daughter to get her to eat things is to make dinner to sort of these exploratory sessions where we talk about, okay, like here's a carrot and here's a cucumber, like eat one and tell me how it tastes. Now eat the other one and tell me how it tastes. And you can be suggestive. Like I can eat the carrot and be like, oh, this one is really nice and sweet. And this one is, and the cucumber is nice and is more watery, but they're both crunchy. And then talk about the differences in the colors. Because, you know, kids physically and mentally, they like sort of sorting things into buckets,
Totally.
Cause they're still building their view of the world and still figuring out how things work. So suggesting ways in which they can sort foods like that, it's always fun. Literally just last night, my wife roasted some carrots. We had some fish and we roasted some carrots for dinner. And we had yellow and orange carrots. And my daughter last night decided that she didn't want to eat the yellow carrots, which is, you know, generally we're fine with that. It's like if you don't want to eat one thing today, as long as you're eating the other stuff, that's fine. But the way we got her to eat the yellow carrots was we did a blind taste test where first I cut the carrots up and she said, I like the orange carrots better. Mm. And then I said, are you sure? And then so we first blindfolded my wife. And I fed her the carrots, and my daughter saw me doing that.
This is getting very exotic for dinner time.
And then we blindfolded me, did the same thing, and then we did it to her. And so she very readily ate the yellow and orange carrots after she saw that it was sort of like this experimental thing, that there was this kind of fun game that we were playing. And of course, every kid is different. But, you know, my kid, I know that she is into these sort of comparative games. Like she likes sorting rocks. She likes sorting leaves. And so if you can sort of incorporate the thing that she's interested into the meal, without making it sort of like a lie or a trick, then she's definitely going to be more into the meal. And that's something that is well researched also. You know, the more the, you know, our food preferences are very strongly associated with the circumstances under which we experience them. So, you know, for me, it's like my mom's dumplings taste better than any other dumpling. And it's not because they're literally better than any other dumpling. It's because I associate them with positive memories eating them growing up.
Yeah. And I guess that's the answer to your question that many people ask, which is like, oh, are you kids born with adventurous palates, or, you know, do you luck out, or, you know, was it something genetic because of who you are? Well,
so there is evidence that, so, you know, the difference between taste and flavor. So taste is, you know, something that we perceive on our tongues, which right now it's, you know, salty, sour, sweet, savory, and bitter. Although there's evidence now that, you know, we taste fat and calcium on our tongues as well. So sure. Maybe there's seven basic tastes, but maybe more. Who knows? But those five basic tastes are things that are innate. You know, babies, before they learn anything, are attracted to umami and salty and sweet, and are unattracted to, you know, are what's the word, deterred by bitter and sour flavors. And there's evidence that those preferences are also hereditary. So parents who tend to prefer sweeter things will also have children that prefer sweeter things. But even in utero, and especially once we're out of the womb, our taste preferences are extremely plastic for the first several years of our lives. And even up through adolescence, basically, very, very plastic, in the sense that they can be molded as opposed to elastic, where you can try and influence them, but they always snap back. So the associations that you make when a child is in utero, you know, their flavors and aromas are transferred through what the mother eats into the baby. Yeah. So in utero, and then also post-birth, in early childhood, all of those associations that you make are going to factor into what a child enjoys later on in life.
So even after all that, we still get a lot of questions. So like, okay, but still, tell me how to do this. And for one of those, I'm going to go to Peter in Virginia.
Hi, we have a 10-month-old, and we're wondering if you have any tips for making vegetables more enjoyable for kids. It seems like a lot of the pre-made baby foods are mixed with fruit, and they're really sweet. And mixing fruit in really will get them to eat, but it makes it even harder in the future to get them to eat things that aren't that sweet. So just wondering if you have any tips about how to make vegetables either pureed or whole more appealing to those kinds of kids who are just starting to eat. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. So Kendra, like you were saying, you know, there is the sugar sort of tripwire. And it's true. Like when I was at the point where we were buying pre-made purees and stuff for our kid, just to have something like on hand for when we need it. And it was like, oh, everything is mixed with pureed apple. Everything is mixed with grape juice, you know? But if you're cooking at home and you don't want to add all that sweetness, what do you do? My thought, like you said, was, you know, kids are attracted to other tastes as well. And umami, seems to me to be, you know, umami is highly present in breast milk. Like, what if you just start seasoning your vegetables with soy sauce and fish sauce? But
well,
what do you think?
I mean, certainly that's one route to go. You know, things that you find delicious are generally also going to be delicious to kids, with the exception of, you know, very bitter flavors. But even that is something that can be learned as a child. You know, for us, you know, we did baby-led weaning, which is a process where you basically don't do purees, and as soon as the kid is old enough to sit up on their own, so at around 6 months or so, you start them on solid foods. And basically ever since 6 months, my daughter, with a few exceptions, has been eating exactly what we eat for dinner. Like we don't make special meals, we don't have special snacks in the house just for her. And you know, the real trick is to you know, again, to make sure that eating is a positive experience for them. So you don't, you know, don't pressure them to eat. Don't say, if you don't eat this, you're not going to get that.
Yeah.
Don't make it into a bargain, because that you see sort of the evidence shows that you see short term benefits from that. You might convince your kid to eat the broccoli if they know that they're going to get chocolate afterwards. But long term, what it means is that they associate more negative feelings with the broccoli because they were forced to eat it, and more positive associations with the chocolate. So then later on, they're going to have a vast preference for chocolate over broccoli, which maybe everyone does anyway. But if instead you make the actual eating part sort of celebratory and fun, then it becomes much easier to do. And the best way that I've found to do that is for me and my wife. Audrey to both really praise each other when we cook, and also talk to each other about how delicious things are. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then also sort of, you know, you can place little subtle psychological tricks on your child. Like, I know my daughter is really, like, currently she's really into dinosaurs, right? And she's learning about carnivores and herbivores. You know, like, I let her pretend that she's like a baby triceratops at the dinner table, so that way she can sort through her food and see what a triceratops is going to eat.
Yeah.
And I know that she loves dinosaurs, so if she can pretend that she's a dinosaur at the dinner table, then she's going to eat, you know, especially an herbivore, she's going to eat more vegetables at the dinner table. But, you know, positive associations. So, like, just telling each other, like, when I eat something, you know, you do over the top reactions, like, this is so delicious, when I'm talking with my wife. And if it's something that my daughter initially said she didn't want to eat, she might not even eat at that meal. But if we keep doing it, and we keep making these positive associations with it, eventually she comes around. You know, and a lot of the research I've read shows that with novel foods, you know, kids, toddlers have neophobia, so they're afraid of things that they're unfamiliar with. So, you know, the more things you can expose them to when they're infants and when they're babies, the better, because that's going to give them a broader palate as they grow up, and you're going to have less trouble introducing them to new foods. But, you know, even so, all kids are going to be afraid of things that they've never tried before. And the evidence shows that most kids need to try a new food, like, at least 6 to 15 times or so before they start actually legitimately enjoying it, if they're ever going to enjoy it. But so, you know, don't be discouraged if the first 6 times they try kale in their life or Brussels sprouts or whatever, you know, whatever thing that they might not have tried before, or chicken, any, you know, whatever it is that they haven't tried before. You don't be discouraged if the first 6 to 12 times they don't like it. Just keep offering it to them, keep giving them, you know, positive environments around it, and eventually they're going to be much more likely to enjoy it.
Yeah. And if all else fails, roast the vegetables really hard with a lot of salt and olive oil.
Yes. The other thing to bear in mind is that one of the things that is very that is shown to be hereditary is our perception of bitterness. So if you or your spouse or, you know, your co-parent or whoever, genetic parent, are especially averse to bitter things, so like bitter greens in particular, like broccoli or kale, if you particularly dislike those vegetables, then it's very likely that your kid also has heightened sensitivity to the bitterness in those vegetables. So if you know, don't try and force your kids to like things that you yourself don't like, because there could be a genetic thing involved in that as well.
Yeah. Although we can also train ourselves into like most everyone likes chocolate, and chocolate's actually very bitter. But anyway, let's move on to another question. And this is, you know, we've been talking a lot about toddlers and little kids, and this is for a little bit of an older situation. I think this will probably speak to your inner nerd, Kenji.
Okay.
Hi, Francis. This is Maya calling from St. Paul, Minnesota, where I'm a 7th grade math teacher. So I'm not cooking with kids directly right now, but since we're starting the year online, I'm taking advantage of everyone being at home by making math cooking videos as a part of my asynchronous instruction. A big part of 7th grade math is fractions and ratios and proportions, which come up so much in cooking and baking and shopping, and I want my students to see how what they're learning is really useful in their lives. So this week I have the recipe for rhubarb cake, but I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do next. And I was just wondering if you guys had any ideas for recipes or topics to use with my math students, especially things that they could really simply, replicate at home. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, I wish I had her as a math teacher, because that's amazing.
Yeah, that sounds lots of fun. I mean, I think I have the perfect thing, which also happens to be what my children's book is about, but pizza. I mean, pizza seems like the perfect thing for learning fractions, both in terms of baking it and in terms of serving it. So baker's percentages, I don't know if Maya, if she's familiar with baker's percentages, but it's what professional bakers use to bake. So the way baker's percentages work is that you consider your flour, whatever the weight of flour you have, to be 100%. And then all of your other ingredients are fractions thereof or percentages thereof. So a basic pizza recipe would be 100% flour. So say whatever that is, it could be a kilogram, it could be 100 grams, whatever you want. And then 60% hydration. So whatever the weight of the flour, 60% of that, you add in water, 2% salt, 1% yeast, 1% yeast. Like, so that's a very simple, basic, pizza recipe. And, you know, so that I think is the ideal thing for teaching scaling. So, you know, you can say if I'm making pizza for two, I'm going to start with 350 grams of flour. And so teaching them how to figure out, okay, what is 60% of 350 grams, and developing a recipe that way. You know, or if I'm making it for three, it's going to be 500 grams of flour, et cetera. So baker's percentages are not only useful as a sort of life skill, but they also teach you how to think about fractions and percentages. And then, of course, at the end, pizza, you know, dividing a pizza into fractions, into slices, it's like a literal pie chart that can teach you fractions.
and an actual life skill you will need. Yeah.
Yes. and, you know, and it's not just dividing it into slices, but also, you know, applying toppings to it in different fractions. You know, Sergio likes pineapples, but Anika doesn't. How much of the pizza are we going to put pineapples on? Mm-hmm. How much of it's going to get pepperoni, et cetera? Like, I think there's lots of opportunities for learning about fractions and percentages when it comes to both baking and eating pizza. And pizza is very easy to make at home, and everybody likes pizza.
Maybe pizza is the best food in the world. I might need to read up on that. All right, Kenji, it has been a blast having you, talking kids with you. Congratulations on the book. Good luck with that. Good luck on everything else you're doing.
Oh, thanks so much.
And I'll talk to you again soon, man.
Oh, thank you. It's always good to be on with you.
Kenji Lopez-Alt is Alicia's dad, the author of The Food Lab and the children's book Every Night is Pizza Night. You can read him at the New York Times and on Serious Eats. You can find a bunch of kid-friendly recipes on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up...
My daughter has weaponized food against me. I think our kids both know how much it means to us that they eat what we make them, and they know how to use it and lord it over us. So my daughter will eat her lunch if I put the effort into making it look like a robot.
We hang with Chris Ying, who is that robot lunch maker, and his friend, Momofuku chef David Chang. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. David Chang is one of the most influential chefs probably in American history. I mean, like, he didn't invent fresh ramen or pork buns, but if you've eaten either of those things in this country in the past 15 years and you didn't know where to get them before, you probably have him and his restaurant group Momofuku to thank. He's also the star of the Netflix series Ugly Delicious, the host of the podcast The Dave Chang Show, and oh yeah, he's the author of the brilliant new memoir Eat a Peach. It's so good. I've read it like 8 or 9 times. Like it was my job, because literally it was my job. I was the editor on the book. Anyway, Dave is also a new father to Hugo, who you can see on his Instagram. He is like the Terminator, a perfect eating machine sent back from the future. Only, as we're about to find out, nothing is perfect in Dave's life when it comes to feeding his kid. Chris Ying also joins us. He is Dave's partner in their media company. He's a frequent co-host on that podcast. And he also happens to be, to my mind, one of the greatest writers and editors around. Together, they've done a series of episodes on The Dave Chang Show called Dads, about being dads. All right, so Dave, your son is one, and Chris, you have a 3-year-old and a newborn.
Yep.
So let's start this the way you do most of your dad casts. What's the one thing you did well as a dad this week?
Oh, man. We actually don't do our dad's podcast on a weekly basis because it takes Chang and I more than 1 week to accomplish one positive dad activity. Chang, you got anything?
It's the same thing. I continue to make him food that he did not want to eat. And I that's basically it. I mean, my struggle with him is he doesn't seem to like me very much at all.
This got deep really fast.
Yeah, it got real deep real fast. And he will go to my in-laws, my wife. He'll call them Umma, Appa, Habuji, Hamani, but not me. and he knows he can do it. So I'm trying not to get jealous or lose patience. I'm trying to be calm. And my job is just to make him food like his personal chef. And that's what I'm doing. And he continues to, like yesterday, I made him like all the things that used to work don't work anymore. I used to make him crepes. And now he's just like, he throws it on the floor. Oof. And, you know, if someone else serves it to him, he'll eat it. So there's something going on already.
Oh, my God.
That can't be true. Does he? If Grace gives him the same thing as you,
no, it takes time. Like I get up and I'll cook it, and then I'll try to feed him, and then he won't. And then like 30 minutes later, he starts eating it. I just can't be from me. But all things considered, he gives me grief. He busts me up throughout the day, and then whenever we feed him his bottle and he's about to go to bed, he always gives me a kiss and a hug, and he's like, "I got you, Dad."
There you go.
We'll repeat this game tomorrow.
It's totally at the end of like an NBA game. Yeah. No matter how hard fought it is, you shake hands.
Yeah.
You part.
Yeah. It's a war. It's a war between us, and he's kicking my butt. So what I'm doing well is persistence, and that's what I get.
That's the secret to your life. Chris, what about you? What is the thing you did that you're proud of this week?
I got a food related one. My daughter, sort of similar to Dave's son, has weaponized food against me. I think our kids both know. I think our kids both know how much it means to us that they eat what we make them, and they know how to use it and lord it over us. So my daughter will eat her lunch if I put the effort into making it look like a robot. So I had to do that again yesterday. I was very proud that the gyoza I made good robot ears. And there was a lot of cabbage in them, so she ate those. That's a small victory for me.
That's awesome. I'm into that. So thank you for playing a round of your game with me. Okay, so the Dave Chang Show is mostly not a food podcast, right? But when you do the dad's episodes, I find you two are often getting into hands-on cooking a lot more in the show, and in a way that's very not chefy at all. Like, there cannot possibly be more of a microwave appreciation podcast than the dad's episodes of the Dave Chang Show. And I have come to love my microwave like an actual human brother. But tell us why you love your microwave and what you do with it.
Oh, man. I should say that our new sponsor for the Dave Chang Show is the Microwave National Association. I can't imagine not using a microwave. Like, people are like, oh, an air fryer is great for kids. Like, you know what's better? A microwave. from heating up milk to now, like, I would say majority of meals for Hugo are cooked or reheated in a microwave. And sometimes in the mornings, I'll just cook eggs in the microwave. So I use it for so many things, particularly if I freeze some of his food in a glass container, and then I just pop in the microwave for like a minute, 20 seconds or so, and I know it's going to be perfect. It'll be too hot, and then if I do it like 20 minutes beforehand, it'll be the right temp. So again, reheating foods via microwave, particularly foods for children that are oftentimes not like texturally crunchy, are perfect. Again, I'm working on a lot of stuff that deals with microwaves. I've been a huge fan of microwaves forever.
Well, you're serious.
I find it to be totally it's totally ridiculous that people are opposed to cooking in a microwave. I'm equally as perplexed that they are perplexed at me for using one. I'm like, you literally have I say this not as a joke, we have a machine from the Jetsons future here in present day, and people are like, what's the big deal? I'm like, this thing is unbelievable. It is the most amazing piece of technology in your kitchen collecting dust. 90% of American homes have it, yet only like 20% of the people use it because they think they're going to get radio waves or microwaves, or they don't even know which waves, but they're, complaining to their friend on their cell phone while they're talking about the microwave, which is... I cook rice in it. I cook everything in it, and it doesn't mean that I finish everything in it, but like, it just is an amazing tool to save time.
Well, Dave, you mentioned... you cook eggs in the microwave. How do you do eggs in a microwave?
Well, a lot of it's timing. I mean, you could, if you have a container, you can put it on a lower power setting, like 30 to 40%, and make scrambled eggs. And then if you cook it to the point where it's just before it's done, and then you whisk it, it becomes scrambled eggs.
Oh, wow.
I make chawan mushi all the time because that's a like an egg that he will eat. Like
steamed egg custard.
But I don't use it with, I don't make dashi. I just make it with like milk to give him that extra protein. But also like rice, it cooks rice incredibly well. All frozen spinach, peas. You could put a on a plate, put a whole head of cauliflower, lock it in there for like 12 minutes. And it's going to be perfect. You don't have to waste time putting water to a boil and then straining it out or whatever. You don't have to have any oil. It's perfectly steamed. And then you can mash that up and you can serve that for adults or kids. So any vegetable, for the most part, is amazing. Microwave corn, it's corn season. Like, why boil corn? Just put it in the microwave.
I think the emblematic dad's dish, though, Chang, is your multinational, multi-ethnicity chicken thighs. Like that's the one that has actually changed my entire family's life.
It's about speed, and I get it. And I have never cooking at home before, truly, before my wife got pregnant. I've never really, like, I joke, it's like only learning how to drive a car that's an F1 or a NASCAR and then getting behind a, you know, Honda Accord for the first time. You're like, what? What is going on here? I only know how to drive, you know, go 200 miles per hour. So learning how to rethink about home cooking is great because no one's ever told me this is how you do it in a home kitchen. So probably one of my favorite recipes is take a pound or so of frozen chicken thighs. And usually I take them out of the package and put them in a glass container that you can microwave in.
Okay.
Microwave it for, you know, 10 minutes or so. And knowing that it'll probably just still sort of raw in the center, but the outside of the chicken will be cooked. The big thing for me about home cooking is not doing any extra dishes and doing everything in one pot if humanly possible. And I then cut the chicken, not with knife or putting it on my cutting board, because I know that the interior will still be raw. I cut everything with scissors into bite-sized chunks.
Oh my God.
And then
you're turning into a Korean auntie.
Yeah. I mean,
there's a reason why they're so successful, those Korean aunties.
Or a Chinese auntie, for that matter.
Yeah.
Or my mom. You're my mom.
I take a nonstick wok, which is, again, another thing that people need to learn about is nonstick is your friend, not your enemy. I'm a huge proponent of nonstick, particularly at home. And I will get some oil, olive oil, put some whatever aromatics I want. And that's where I can take this dish to any country in the world or any sort of region. If I wanted to go to like Southeast Asia, I could do garlic and Thai bird chilies and some lemongrass or garlic, ginger, whatever, and then throw my chicken in there. And it's like already done. It needs like 20% more cooking. So by the time the aromatics and whatever vegetables get soft, the chicken's going to be done and it's a quick stir fry. I could turn that into chicken parm if I wanted to. I could take it to Provence. I could turn it into a chowder with corn and potatoes. There's like literally nothing you can't do at this moment, and I can do it all in 12 minutes. I mean, I don't think I've ever made the same microwave chicken dish twice. It's always been some variation of something else because it's so versatile.
Yeah. Chris, you were also a professional cook at one point. I think, you know, less as part of like your personal identity than Dave. But
fair.
Yeah, did you feel like when you, you know, started cooking at home for a family and for your kids, did you feel like your professional cooking like trained you well for it, or like Dave, we just kind of like you had to deprogram yourself?
No, I mean I think I experienced Dave's realization in reverse at first, because, you know, I walked into my first restaurant job when I was 18 or 19, and I had, like, you know, sort of fallen in love with cooking because I could cook for my friends, you know, and I was pretty good at it. And then you walk into a professional kitchen and you're like, oh, nothing that I do at home bears any relevance whatsoever to cooking in a professional kitchen. It's a completely different thing. But, you know, once I had my family, we started cooking at home more, you know, I think that like Dave's cooking mind is obviously like running at that Formula One speed. It's always sort of churning, and he's coming up with a lot of these things. But certainly, like, it's a completely different animal. You're trying to cook for people super quickly with much more restrictions, much less like access to anything you want whenever you want, and you don't have dishwashers. Like, you're like, that's like the number one driving thing, honestly. Like Dave said it, but like half of my cooking decisions in the kitchen are based around not having to wash another dish.
Yeah. Totally. Okay, so we all have pretty young kids. This is probably a different story if your kids are, you know, teens or, you know, grown and their palates have developed over time already. But, you know, if you're cooking in a restaurant and that was your training and that was your motivation, like you want to make things, like you want to push seasonings to the extreme, right? Where things are salty and they're sweet and they're fat and they're spicy and they're acidic to keep people coming back for more. At home, like a, you know, a 2-year-old doesn't really want to eat like that. They're just at a different scale. Like, did you have to like deprogram how you season food?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that like one of the things that Dave and I talk about often is resisting that urge, right? We know how to make our kids eat the things we want them to eat. We just put a ton of salt and sugar and umami in there and they'll eat them. Like I resist every single day sneaking a little bit of fish sauce into the things that my wife is feeding my son right now. He's six months old.
But it's also important to note that this is the time where like you can give them extraordinary amounts of butter and it's okay. I mean, for example, like you don't understand, I'm really trying everything. Hugo's breakfast is problematic now because if you like something one day, you know, I always have to just change it up. And this is going to be the bane of my existence moving forward. So today I found some like old grits. Not old. I just forgot that I had them. And I cooked them in the microwave and I cooked them with water and then milk. And I cooked the hell out of it to make sure that it was like soft. There were no chunks in it. And I probably put in, I don't know, half a cup of grits with water and milk, 2 tablespoons of butter. Like maybe 3, it was a lot of butter. And then I was like,
it was a heaping 2 tablespoons.
And I was like, oh, I have this extra cream that I didn't use last week. And I pour that in and then I added salt and I tasted it. I was like, wow, that is restaurant grade fat. Like amount of fat. Like again, people don't realize when you serve, at least the restaurants I worked in, potatoes, grits, things like that, they're all vehicles for fat. That's it.
50% and butter.
You add as much fat as humanly possible before breaking. That is literally what was taught to me. And that's effectively what I did. Did I add a little olive oil to it to give it some sheen this morning? Of course I did. And I looked at it. I was like, wow, that is got to be 500 calories at minimum. I portioned out 2 4-ounces and I gave it to him. Of course, he didn't eat it for me. My mother-in-law had to sit down with him later as it cooled down and he ate it. And then as I was cooking lunch, because like I'm busy doing things like this today, so I try to cook lunch in the morning, they can reheat. And my mother-in-law's like, oh my God, like, do you have any more of this? I got him the second container. He ate it all. He ate 8 ounces. He had probably 1,000 calories and 25 grams of fat for breakfast. And I was so proud of him. And at any other point in your life, you'd be like, you cannot do that. That is not good for you. So that's the one thing is sugar and salt, maybe not the best thing, but fat for babies is amazing.
It's good for the brain, man.
I'm still living on that baby diet, though, just FYI.
So it's not a surprise. Fat, salt, sugar is amazing. So I try to scale back the salt and sugar. So the one thing I don't skimp out on is the fat because that's what they need right now.
But Shane, do you find yourself doing the same thing? Because it's actually, for me, some of the adjustment in seasoning has as much to do with my kids as it does living with my in-laws. And I'm trying not to use as much salt and sodium and all of that kind of stuff.
100%. But you know what he ate after grits? He ate kimchi.
That's amazing.
You're so proud, though.
I was really proud about that. I mean, he's really loving kimchi. If you just wash it off, it's still spicy. He just can't get enough of it. He'll just keep on packing his mouth full of kimchi, and I'm just like, that's amazing. But think about that. It's very salty still. It's spicy, but it's got probiotics. It's got probiotics.
Good for you.
Good for you.
Make them live forever. All right, Chris. All right, Dave. Thank you so much for coming through. You don't need to invite me onto your show anymore. This was awesome. I really enjoyed this.
We'll have you on the show. But we'll do a different topic, not dad.
Okay. Talk to you guys later.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
David Chang is Hugo's dad, the author of the memoir Eat a Peach, host of The Dave Chang Show and Ugly Delicious on Netflix, and is the chef of Momofuku. Chris Ying is Ruby and Keith's dad, and he's the head of creative at Majordomo Media. That is our show for the week. Actually, no, wait, not yet. We have one more recipe for you. From our friend Edith.
Hi, I'm Edith, and I'm in Ithaca, New York. I want to tell you what I like to make when I don't want to cook. I like to take a cherry tomato, and I like to take it and I want to take some pistachios, and I like to take a bite of the cherry tomato and then put the pistachio into the cherry tomato when the juice is squeezed out. And when I do that, I'll take a bite and it's a good energy snack. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Keep sending us your cooking questions, record them on voice memo on your phone, and email it to contact@splendidtable.org. And it's not too early, and I'm serious, it's not too early to start sending us your Thanksgiving questions. Thank you for listening. Take care. Talk to you next week. The Splendid Table is supported by The One Recipe, a podcast from the team behind The Splendid Table. Host Jesse Sparks talks to chefs and gifted cooks about the stories behind the recipes we know are going to work every single time. Follow wherever you do your podcasts from APM Studios. APM Studios are run by Chandra Cavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.